hate speech and mistrust of pseudo-AI are a matter of timing. You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Mr. Miles Elam. He's a programmer and a pedant and a...
political junkie.
Are it's you still a political junkie?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Oh, yeah. You've seen my Facebook feed. Yeah.
What do you recommend in the theaters right now?
RBG. Ruth Bader Ginsburg.
She did not disappoint?
Oh, man, that woman does not disappoint. The history of her does not. The present does not. She's paid her dues no matter what happens. She could go out in a Times Square and shoot somebody, and she would not lose a single follower.
All right, talk to us about time.
Currently, there is a standard for synchronizing time between servers called NTP, Network Time Protocol, not very imaginatively named.
I recall there being old DDS attacks you could do with it because it's a UDP protocol, and there could be problems until it got updated. We've covered it in the past.
Yeah, yes. And it is down to the second.
Just the second?
It might be the millisecond, but okay. I'm pretty sure it's down to the second.
I mean, you know, that's fine.
No, actually, it's down to the millisecond. I take that back.
Okay.
Well, researchers at Stanford University teamed up with Google, and they are creating technology that will be able to track time down to the nanosecond.
What? I mean, I understand the reason for that in some situations, but over the network, why is a nanosecond matter considering many things may need to be done at a, you know, have to be correlated over multiple distances, and so you have to wait for packets to be transferred.
That's exactly
stuff. Like,
why they want to have it to the nanosecond. One of their big drivers to have this done is Wall Street.
Oh, of course. Syncing transactions and appropriate – making sure that whoever won actually won.
Right. Now, just figuring out how to get stuff in terms of time resolution down to the nanosecond is hard enough. But one of the dilemmas with doing this is how do you do this, as you were mentioning, over geographic areas?
Yeah.
And this is why you need folks from Stanford University and Google teaming up to work on it, because depending upon the geographic location – of the server, of the person who's, you know, doing the item,
yeah,
the time will need to be adjusted accordingly.
Yeah, and there's shift and such as well. So it's interesting because I can't imagine a way of doing it reliably. Have you read how they do it?
No, they don't have details in the article about it, but I'm doing this as a thought experiment. When you're talking about time zones, just saying, this is – you know, I am in this time zone, therefore midnight begins at this time.
Or, I mean, I think it's pretty common for everybody to just say UTC. Use UTC, and then depending on when you want to display to a user, you can translate that into their current time to render that. So if everyone agrees on UTC, that's one point. But if your computer and my computer are not in the same physical environment, or even if they are in the same physical environment, making sure that my offset and your offset are compensated for when we communicate is really tricky.
Yes, it is. So you would need to figure out your exact geographic location and then figuring out the latency between two points in order to get that time resolution down correctly. For example, when you say, what time is it to sync your clock, you need to know exactly how far the time server is and how much latency is involved in order to do that. And that's where a lot of the difficulty comes in.
Here's an example. Let's say there's three trusted parties. We won't even talk about the security level of this, just three trusted parties. There's Greg up in Canada, you and me, and we're all in different places. And Greg wants to sell us – what do they sell in Canada? Maple syrup. So Greg wants to sell us some maple syrup, and he's setting the price point. And you and I both bid on the same – how do you – gallon? How do you – it's not bushel. Some volume of maple syrup, a barrel of maple syrup. So we both place a bid at the, quote, same time or about the same time. And we don't want to be in a situation where when Greg receives one of our requests, he accepts it and then they sold out, because theoretically the time it took for our request to get to him are a different rate. And even if I asked for it first and you won, or you got to him first but I asked for it first from a time perspective, mm-hmm, that would be an unfair advantage because your network, maybe you're closer to, maybe you're in Oregon or something. And so therefore it's a crucial thing to have these trusted computers to say the time at which I made the placement of this order is exactly this time down to the nanosecond, and
or
then we can all agree upon
it. As lowest granularity as you can make it, smallest granularity. Now, there's also another aspect to this, which is security, which is what happens if I say, oh, I'm actually in Baja, Mexico, Baja, California in Mexico. And then I send a message, and so it goes, oh, I'm going to time adjust that. No, you can't do that. You have to have some assurances about who you're talking to and mm-hmm. where they actually are and what the latencies are on the network in order really to make cool. that work. So it's a much harder problem than just saying, hey, let's bring this time resolution down.
Will this be a new part of the spec for the time protocol, like a new version 2?
It may eventually. For now, it's just going to be, you know, people working on it. It's still a work in progress.
That's great.
And they will have to work out a lot of those issues that we've described and more that we haven't thought of or I haven't thought of.
I'm sure. Well, I look forward to hearing a little bit more of the details of it. So you have some story about Facebook, and I've heard of this company before. It's a social media company, yeah?
Yes. This one is a story about hate speech and the Declaration of Independence.
What?
This is echoes of last year, actually, where NPR had tweeted out the Declaration of Independence, but they could only tweet it out 140 characters at a time.
And NPR did that?
Yes.
That's kind of funny.
For 4th of July, you know, it's a patriotic thing to do. It's absolutely on point with regard to, you know, current events and or historical events, I should say. It was relevant.
And it always is in the States.
And yet, when they were tweeting out these passages in isolation, you had people come out getting angry about them.
Oh, interesting. That was last year, NPR on Twitter, and this year it happened on Facebook?
Well, a variation of it. In last year, when it talked about princes and tyrants, people started getting defensive about, why are you talking about Trump and making this all partisan, when they were actually just quoting the Declaration of Independence. Rewriting it.
Reposting it.
Reposting it, thank you. Well, reposting?
Yeah. Submitting it. Posting it. Not rewriting it. Plagiarizing it.
How sad is it that we think of, like, plagiarizing is one word that comes to mind when we think of historical documents.
It's out of copyright, right?
Yeah. It actually was never under copyright.
Of course not.
Now, Facebook, there's a bit of a wrinkle. It was posting portions of the Declaration, or a news organization, I should say, was posting the Declaration of Independence.
In the same fashion to say, hey, it's Independence Day, let's celebrate, here's the Declaration.
A bit longer, but mm-hmm. yes. And this was a small newspaper in Texas called The Vindicator. And they were doing, you know, the piecemeal delivery of it. This time it was Facebook that flagged part of it as hate speech. Facebook has since apologized for the fact that that it flagged the Declaration of Independence as hate speech.
Wow, those filters are a little too tight, aren't they? What section was hate
again,
speech?
But then again, so the portion that was considered hate speech was, quote, he has exited domestic insurrections amongst us, talking about George II.
Sure.
And has endeavored to bring on the inhabitants of our frontiers, the merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an indistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions.
So the racism in it, that's what you're talking about.
In other words, what we would describe today as hate speech.
Yes, perfectly valid. I mean, it's interesting, but you know, when you're quoting a document like that, there is a level of acceptance in quoting it, right? You have to decide where that boundary is. Of course, if you're using that kind of verbiage in your own speech, yeah, there's a problem. But you're quoting a document that's a party founding document of the states. It should be kind of whitelisted.
Well, see, there's the question. Yeah, whitelisted. Nice. Okay.
Good call.
The thing about it is that it is a historical document, and there are many – Lord knows there are many pieces of literature and culture from our past that are considered problematic today.
Yeah.
Even ones as revolutionary – see what I did there – like the Declaration of Independence. That said, was this actually a bug? It got flagged as hate speech. Facebook found it and went, okay, that one's okay. We're going to let it through.
It got flagged as hate speech and then someone looked at it. It didn't cause it to be stopped being posted, or did it get delayed in the posting?
No, it was put up and then was pulled back by the AI. And then they had to you know, repost it or make it available again.
Right. So basically, the system said this looks like hate speech. It kind of told the newspaper. The newspaper went, no, I don't think so. Then it went to review to somebody, and they agreed, yeah, it's not okay, and it went forward.
And it was bad publicity.
It's not a big deal. It's humorous. But the thing is, if the document has hate speech in it, the document has hate speech in it. It seemed like a pretty valid – it seems pretty valid.
There's the question. Like, is it really hate speech when you're talking about 200-plus years ago?
Was it hate speech then? Or are you saying is it hate speech now?
Hate speech is a legal identifier.
If you're calling a class of people savages, I don't know. It seems like it's pretty inflammatory.
Oh, it's absolutely racist. But I was saying that hate speech is a specific legal identifier currently. And that legal status did not exist then. So was it hate speech? By definition, no.
Come on.
Was it racist? Yes.
Because that's not a legal definition?
Right.
All right, interesting. Hey, speaking of whitelisting, because that's a software term you use quite a bit, blacklisting and whitelisting, and we actually used to talk a lot about graylisting. And you kind of scoffed at using that term whitelisting. Which,
yeah, in general, I've been moving a lot more toward allow lists and deny lists.
And I think that's probably a better – I was going to ask what's the thing to use instead of denoting coloring for it. I'm not sure of the history of it, but it looks like whitelisting kind of became popular in the email era, and spam era, where it became really important for people to individually decide, oh, this person gets through my spam filters, this person doesn't.
Whitelist was – it came after the fact. Blacklist was the original term.
Yeah. It's just interesting that it's correlated – In our vernacular, in spam and email, because I think of it as a more generic concept than that. But of course, that's when it would become a common term. Does it have a history of racist connotations? Do you know?
I don't know the etymology of it.
So I'm looking at the Wikipedia entry, and unfortunately, they do not have a. You know, sometimes they have etymology entries. They don't seem to have that. But interesting. If you know the history of the term whitelist and blacklist, it probably, you know what? It probably actually, the history probably comes from blacklisting. The general software concept is you make it, and you probably know this because you used email before, but you make a list that says, do not allow these things to run, and you can make another list that says, go ahead and allow these things to run. And the way you set your system up kind of infers its security and capabilities, because if you have an allow list, it's a very different kind of feature than having a disallow list. Traditionally, allow lists are much safer to implement. Disallow lists are kind of like after the fact, these look like bad players, don't allow these. And it's just a lot easier to keep creating things that don't get captured by the disallow list. So allow lists are a safer way to build infrastructures out.
Yeah, deny by default. Yeah. I'm trying to look up etymology of blacklist, but it's going to be pretty quick, so I don't know what I can find in such a short time. I do know the term the black sheep of the family. I know that that is not a racist term, for example.
What's that come from?
If you have a sheep with white wool, mm-hmm. you can dye it any color. If you have a black sheep,
that's the color
you've
it is.
Got black.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
And so, therefore, the black sheep was the undesirable of the flock.
Because of its inflexibility.
Mm-hmm.
Cool. Hey, looks like you have a story for us about Jefferson, since we're doing the memorial. It looks like we're doing the memorial show.
This actually is kind of ties into that Facebook story about blocking the Declaration of Independence. Because there is a quote for that from none other than Thomas Jefferson. It's one of the quotes that's up in the Jefferson Memorial. Panel number 4, in fact. I am not an advocate for frequent changes in laws and constitutions, but laws and institutions must go hand in hand with the progress of the human mind. As that becomes more developed, more enlightened, as new discoveries are made, more new truths discovered, and manners and opinions change with the change of circumstances, institutions must advance also to keep pace with the times. We might as well require a man to wear still the coat which fitted him when a boy as a civilized society to remain ever under the regimen of their barbarous ancestors. So when I think of terms like what we were saying as hate speech, it very much brings to mind the person who is most responsible for the writing of the Declaration of Independence, to say that, yeah, we can refer back to these things, but things do change. We can say that these things are now hate speech because our circumstances have changed, our understanding has changed, and we know the hurt that was involved in that time, even if it was not recognized by the people in charge at the time.
I like that you pull the quote from Jefferson to talk about it, since he is one of the primary writers of the Declaration. Very cool. Feels like a nice history show for the states, at least. What is the company Box, Miles?
Sorry, I have to look it up because I really don't know.
Oh, okay.
Transforming the way people and organizations work so they can achieve their greatest ambitions. Well, isn't that vague?
Box, formerly Box.net, based in Redwood City, California, is a cloud content management and file sharing service for businesses. The company uses a freemium business model to provide cloud storage and file hosting for personal accounts and businesses. Official clients and apps are available for Windows, macOS, and several mobile platforms. Box was founded in 2005.
Yeah, that'll teach me to go to the actual company's website to find out about them rather than Wikipedia.
quick hint. When you want to find a company's what a company actually is, just search for the name and do parens company and add Wikipedia on there, and you'll find the company with actually like a description of what the heck it is.
Yeah. Pro tip.
Pro tip. So Box CEO has a quote. What's he talking about?
Well, Box CEO is concerned that
– his name is Aaron, by the way, right?
Yeah, Aaron Levy.
Okay.
Is concerned that mistrust of Google and Facebook, because they've been in the news a lot lately with regard to trust issues.
Okay. It feels like Facebook and Google have been in the news the last 10 years. I mean
– yes, and I would say Facebook more so, but yeah. There is an issue of like they have our data. What are they doing with it? Wait, you said you're going to do this, but now it turns out it's doing that, not to mention whole election tampering. The CEO of Box, who so far hasn't had any bad press that I'm aware of, is concerned that this mistrust is going to act as he puts it, a contagion that could spread to every tech company.
Is the mistrust growing?
I believe it is, yes. And I mean, not just in general media, but I mean, you have the show Westworld and spoiler alert.
So the thing is, though, I don't want to do a spoiler alert on that show. Go watch the show if you like it. But I don't feel like it's growing to the point of causing negative effects to the corporations. They're doing fine. They're still hiring. I mean, sure, there's a kind of a general zeitgeist now that, oh, Facebook's, you know, getting my data. But I don't think that's actually affecting the business models of them.
They've had a fair amount of pull in government in terms of lobbying of late. If they start being perceived in the same way that, say, the tobacco industry are, or the oil companies, or things like that, then you could start seeing –
or the cable company.
Yeah. You could start seeing a push away from them, you know, not many things being put in their favor, a bias being put against them, or just people not liking them, and you ending up with the Comcast effect. People just like, I hate them. You know?
Yeah.
And that's something that – other tech companies are worried about. And I think there is actually a pretty good reason for them to worry, that guilt by association, because there has been a non-trivial amount of companies being a bit blasé about, yeah, privacy is over. We're collecting all that data. What's the big deal? Like, that's just what everyone's doing. It's the industry standard. And people are starting to recognize what that means. When you have a credit agency getting hacked, and basically it amounts to everyone's information is now compromised.
I get the idea that the populace is going to become more and more aware of the trade-offs they have with privacy. And these, to me, are good things that people think about that more.
I don't believe that that's necessarily the case. I don't believe that the opinions are going to be more nuanced. I believe that with regard to the tech industry and people's interactions with it, things happen in a lot more broad strokes.
Okay.
So before, you had a lot more people going like, oh, this is neat. Oh, look what I can do with this tech. Oh, look what – to becoming a broad stroke of, look what they're trying to find out about me. I don't know. I can't trust them. I don't want to do this. This is
– okay, but that's a good thing. And it's a good stance to be in.
Skepticism is a good thing.
So you're thinking it's going to go beyond skepticism to like righteousness or some kind of dogma structure where people don't think about it. They just say, no, 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 no.
In terms of populations, I believe that people are strongly dogmatic, mm-hmm. either for promoting a particular item or being against it and having some animus towards it.
So what's the concern of like polluting the tech space that Aaron Levy, the CEO of Box, is saying that it could cause us to roll backwards on some features of our society?
He's worried about, for example, government action against Facebook. There's hypothetical.
Yeah, some that, bad law being implemented that has to do something that doesn't affect.
Well, if you were to take it from one political vantage point, you might say, what if they get smacked down for having the ads that were biased against non-whites getting housing, which has been a news story that we've covered entirely for too long about Facebook. And then
not
they step in and start.
Excuse me. It's not our fault that we had to cover it for too long.
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I did not mean to give that impression. I mean that we first covered it, and then a year later, Facebook still hadn't fixed it.
Yes.
Because that's where regulation can come in and say, like, no, you have to do this or you're facing a fine. Do this or you're going to get this section shut down.
I agree. It's a good motivation for tech companies to be aware of the side effects of their business models, that if you start losing the interest of your potential customers, you're going to suffer. And I can think of many industries that have had major regulation after problems emerged, right? You had giant housing booms and giant construction booms in cities, and then you had giant fires that caused lots of people to die. And so the side effect of that is really good regulations around fire protection in buildings. These are benefits to society at some level. Less people die now in building fires than used to die in building fires. So at some level, it's a good thing to occur, assuming that there can be laws that are effective in causing benefits to society and also the use of technology at the same time. So I guess the concern I would have would be bad legislation, not legislation at all.
I gave a bad example. You're right. Or at least one that's definitely defensible or arguable.
Unless you have a stance where all regulations are bad, any law is a bad law.
Well, I would think of the repeal of net neutrality. Here's one that comes to mind. That's one that a lot of tech companies were vehemently against.
Yes.
It was still repealed by the FCC.
Oh, and so maybe those tech companies kind of lost their footing in Congress and in general, and therefore when the FCC said, no, we're going to do this, which is, of course, beneficial to ISPs and not really the individual.
Well, pushing for that legislation, ignoring the tech industry, but also doing it in such a way that it may be there for the purposes of enriching existing players rather than for a public good.
Yeah. So you think that if the tech companies hadn't lost their kind of honorable position in the eyes of society, that maybe their argument to keep net neutrality strong would have been listened to in a more effective way?
No, I don't believe that to be the case. I believe that it was a foregone conclusion. Someone had a goal in mind in terms of repealing net neutrality before Ajit Pai was even assigned to be chairman at SEC. I believe that he was actually installed in that position for that express purpose.
Of course. I guess you bring this up, though, with regards to the general feeling of tech companies and their loss.
Right. I don't mean this as this is something that has occurred. I mean in terms of it's a warning about where this road could lead.
Yeah,
that if you have an erosion of trust, then you're going to have more interactions with the government and government intervention than you would have originally planned on or expected
wanted. This fear of legislation and fear of control is why we have so many sector-based regulations, if you will, or self-imposed regulations, like the rating system in the United States for film, right? So you go to a movie and you see an R rating or a PG-13 alt rating. That's not a government regulation at all.
Right.
That's a movie industry regulation. And the reason why the movie industry strongly believes in doing that is so that government won't come in and regulate. It's a self-regulation that allows them to be more flexible in what they do.
Right.
So
same with the advisory lyrics on music and
exactly, and in a lot of ways,
Tipper Gore. Yeah. Anyway,
wait. Why is what's the problem with the rating on lyrics?
It had a very strong racial bias. I'll leave it at that for now.
Okay.
It's not a conversation to get into right now.
Yeah. Okay. So, in any case, the concern would be this kind of thing will erode the trust, and if we can sum up Aaron Levy's concern, that this will erode the trust in all technology and people become more dogmatic and less trusting in general, and maybe that lead to bad legislation that could damage the tech sector. Huh. Interesting.
Or
it's an interesting idea.
Or from a business standpoint, it could hurt them just because one of the underlying business model to many of these companies is that you are entrusting your data to their care, mm-hmm. for it to be easier for you to access, to manipulate, to be able to use.
Yeah.
And if you erode that trust, you erode people's willingness to give that data to the company, and then you, of course, you erode the ability of that company to be in business.
Yeah.
Or at least, you know, do what a lot of tech companies have done recently, which is have a license to print money, essentially.
All right. Let's talk about the lack of AI.
Well, that's a funny thing. AI has been a very competitive item right now for companies. You have some amazing things. Like Google was in the news recently for having an AI that could make dinner reservations for you, but sound like a human being.
Amazing. I heard the demo of it. Incredible. And speaking of Google and deep learning stuff, AI deep learning stuff, I continually am impressed with – I've uploaded all my photos to Google. So when I want to find a photo, I just do a little text search, right? It gives me the file name, and then I can actually get the raw file from my local library system. It's amazing. The other day I just –
But it identifies what's in the photo as well.
It's so incredibly – I'll type, oh, I know that photo is black and white, and it's taken at a riverbed. So it's kind of like water, black and white, you know, 30 photos, whatever. I don't have a lot of black and white photos, 30 photos. One of them is exactly what I was looking for. And we're talking about, you know, 400,000 photos. I have a lot of photos. So having that capability is fantastic. And, of course, you know, people say, well, just run that code yourself, you know, do it yourself. The issue is that I have to then have that software running on a system that has access to all my files all the time. Instead, I just slowly build up all my photos up on their service, and then I have those features. And then as they start detecting more and more things, it just kind of works. Pretty amazing. I mean, yeah, lack of privacy, of course, definitely.
Right. But this is also Google, who has a large army of data scientists, statisticians, who are able to get this working. Not all outfits have this. So many people want to push AI, and they see the promise of AI, but they just don't quite have the technology where it needs to be useful. So some tech companies have quietly been hiring people to pretend that they're bots.
I see.
Because trying to get the bots to work and work at a high enough rate is more expensive than just hiring a bunch of people to give canned answers to something using the non-artificial intelligence in their skulls. Now, it turns out that many of those people that are being hired for these relatively low-paying drudge work are in many ways hoping that bots will take it over so they don't have to do that anymore. They can move on to other things. But at the same time, it is interesting how you have a lot of hype having to do with AI and a lot of promise and demonstrated results like we see from many of the larger companies and many of their public demos. But because other companies don't have the same chops and they're not wanting to be left out and they still want that VC money, there's a little bit of cutting corners. Now, here's the question. Does it matter?
It's interesting. It makes a lot of sense in the sense that it is – most likely the stuff they're deciding to do is on that cutting edge where AI would fulfill the role if they built up the data set and mm-hmm. they did all the work necessary to do it. Maybe not as good. I mean, obviously not as good as a human necessarily. Probably faster when they actually get up there.
Well, it depends.
But at the same time, investing all that research first to find out if it's a viable need, it doesn't make as much sense if you can just hire some people. I mean, the initial test run of having it be humans is much cheaper to do. That's a really interesting prop
yes,
space.
That's a really curious thing, though, is because you have the ethical issues of how did you sell this product to get your seed money? Well, it's going to be AI. Here we're hiring people, so it's not really an AI. But you plan to do AI? What if – where does the ethical line get drawn where you intend to have AI and they're working on it, so you just have people filling in a stopgap? What happens if you get into the situation where you tried AI – and you just couldn't get it to work right, so now you're sticking with people because...
But what you do is you just hire people named Al and Allison, and those are all the people at work. And so the A in AI stands for those two people, right? So it's not a big deal. As long as you don't say artificial intelligence, you're totally... Yeah, you're right. That if you're getting your seed money and you're doing that kind of thing and you're not actually implementing the technology that you're proposing to do, of course that's not ethical. Speaking of – you mentioned the idea of having humans do machine tasks. This has a general term and actually a service on Google – I'm sorry, Amazon. The term is called Mechanical Turk, and Amazon actually has a feature, a service like that where you basically say, I need these things done, and somebody out in their pool of people will do this. And you can have them do lots of things. It's a pretty neat resource for humans to do inexpensive tasks. Do you know what the Mechanical Turk actually comes from? You know that term is from?
I used to. I have since forgotten.
From 1770 until the destruction fire in 1854, a chess playing machine, quote unquote machine, was created. It was called the Turk. It was also known as the Mechanical Turk or the Automaton Chess Player. And it was a chess-playing machine where a person actually sat under the board and controlled the game. But it was suggested that actually it was all done via machine. So you'd get a really good chess player who was small and wouldn't mind being in tight places. And you'd stick him in this machine and then you'd invite people to play the machine. But of course, it was really just a person sweating away down below. So in any case, that process... There's great pictures of it and stuff. I'll link to it on the website about the different Mechanical Turks that have been made over time. It seems a little ridiculous that Amazon would call the service that, but I guess it's kind of appropriate. I don't like the idea of thinking of humans as machines. I think that's kind of unethical in itself. You shouldn't think of – like being able to take well, it's just FTE. It's just people. Throw them at the problem. I feel like you should think about people differently than a computer.
You're not fond of the Industrial Revolution model of human being and
as a resource? No, human beings are not a resource.
Are a resource. It's a question of whether or not they are a valued and precious resource rather than a simple commodity that can be discarded and replaced.
I think talking about things as a resource has its implications and meanings, and I think you shouldn't put humans into that grouping. I don't think you should try to dehuman people. I think you should really try to separate those concepts out because you don't want to start thinking them in the same way as you do a different type of resource.
So when you say that you're an iOS developer and someone else is an Android developer, you are not resources?
No, I'm people with skills. I just think that...
But different people have different skills, and therefore they're more applicable to a problem.
Sure. But that's about who the person is. The more you try to make sure that you think about people as individuals, the less likely you're to do things that will cause harm to people. If you start to collide the concepts of like resources and ownership and things of that nature with people, you muddy what your ethical responsibility is to human beings is.
I disagree. And I guess my disconnect there is I don't believe that referring to people as resources is the problem. It's the commodification where people talk about a dollar value to everything and therefore assigning dollar value to human worth, like intrinsic human worth. That's where I feel the danger comes into play. But we're splitting hairs.
Yeah, so definition of resource, a stock or supply of money, materials, staff, and other assets that can be drawn on by a person or organization in order to function effectively. So, of course, it's staff, therefore, you know. But you notice that other assets. So the definition itself is talking about assets and puts in staff and people in that group. That's fine. It's how their language works. There's nothing like specifically wrong about that. But I think if you want to try to put upon yourself that you think in certain ways, and the way you think is derived in and controlled and managed quite a bit by the words you use, you should really try to do your best to separate out concepts that are inhuman and human, so that you don't dump people into the same thought process as, oh, I've got this many, you know, bushels of hay and I have this many staff members. Those should be different things in your mind. Those should be at some level different. So I don't know. Yeah, just
they can't be separated out once you need to get a job done, though. Somewhere along the line, you need to assign a certain number of people to move the bushels of hay.
I have no problem with assigning people to tasks.
Which is, what do you have in your pool of resources to move the bushel of hay? And versus a time constraint. Sooner or later, they need to merge.
Now, whether I don't think they ever have to merge.
No.
From a vocabulary perspective, they don't have to merge.
No. I mean merge as in terms of sooner or later, those people are going to have to lay hands on those bales of hay.
Great.
And there's a certain period of time that's going to take to move it from point A to point B.
And I have no problem with you using those terminologies. You say those people will have to put their hands on those things. That's fine. What I'm saying is that when you say – like, I would prefer our language to not be able to associate a human being and a stack of cash as the same type of thing in the structure.
I agree.
I would rather have a terminology that separated those concepts out so that we always think about people differently than we do about everything else. That's all. But I'm more of a humanist. I think it's important for us to
in general, I agree with
to
you.
Give dignity to humans.
We're just going in different directions.
Yeah.
You were saying that resource and wealth are fairly equivalent, so you don't want human beings dumped into that bucket. And I am saying that I don't think wealth and resources should be the same bucket. I think they should be detached, and resources becomes an umbrella term. That's where the disconnect comes in. So we're splitting hairs.
I don't know if there should ever be a general term that groups together value of money and ownership and land, things of that nature, and humans in the same group. I don't know if we need that ability in our languages. We should separate those concepts out. But, you know, they're already in there. I'm not going to change the language. Just a harebrained idea.
Now, as we talked about AI earlier, not all problems can be reduced to just hire people. Sometimes AI comes out ahead on its own merits. And this is happening in China. As reported in Xinhua, that the group of 15 top doctors, of which I don't know how they measured top doctors, but let's assume for the purpose of this that they are 15 top doctors in China, and they are working as oncologists, so they're working in tumor diagnosis. The AI beat those doctors in figuring out which brain tumors would end up being malignant and going on to hematoma expansion.
Interesting. So this is another example of deep learning and image processing and beating humans at the skill.
Right. Didn't just beat them. Beat them by a factor of 2 to 1.
Wow.
They were twice as likely to get a correct diagnosis or correct prediction from the information made available about a brain tumor than the human beings were.
And this was the visual information only?
I actually don't know. Okay. I'm assuming it was because that's how you would look at it. But then again
– well, of course, there's other symptoms that could rely upon that. And that symptomology might not even be codified into text. It might be like, you know, a very experienced brain tumor specialist might also have a meeting or look at the specs of the person and go, wow, this person feels like, and really they're picking up on other things that are occurring for the human. But that's fascinating. The 2 to 1 seems pretty drastic.
Yeah, the BioMind, which is the name of the AI, was correct 87% of the time, human beings 66%. on average.
What,
and
what's
then,
the name? The name. This thing has a name. It. So somebody owns the tech. There's patents on it. It's like one of those things where very soon we're going to be the best doctor you possibly could have is owned by a corporation. It's not an individual. They can't be bought or, you know, enticed to be spread their knowledge or anything that.
There's a cynical part of me that says that's already the case with Palo Alto Medical Foundation. But that's a whole other argument. Another part that was interesting about this is that the AI only took 15 minutes to diagnose the 225 cases. The doctors took twice as long.
Oh.
To get a worse result.
It was twice as long. I would assume it would take a lot longer for a human to do it. So a Chinese AI beats 15 doctors at their expertise, which happens to be specific complicated image processing, which we're really good at right now. Okay.
Yep.
Yeah, it's pretty cool.
I mean, and it's as good at diagnosing neurological diseases as senior doctors. I don't think they went against the top 15 this time. They were just doing a sampling of senior doctors. Had a 90% accuracy rate.
So does this mean that we can, like, take chess? Of course, computers are better than humans. Go, computers are better than humans. Brain tumor detection, computers are better than humans.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have a feeling, Miles?
We're a hop, skip, and a jump from, like, right now, doctors can do remote surgeries, like, with remote. We're at that point now where doctors are starting to have things overlaid on top of their work surface so they can see where they're going inside, although their training also helps a lot with that, but having that extra guide is helpful. To having autonomous systems doing these surgeries, like, the ethical issues are there. But we're technically –
I don't think there's ethical issues if the sensing system and the probe and the robotic arm and all of that is like the system wants to – I want to cut that and then suture both sides of that and then cut that chunk out. And it just kind of shows you what it wants to do. And then it could say, let's run a fake pass and see what it looks like. And then the doctor's finally like, let's do it. And they don't actually have to move the scalp themselves at all. They're just saying when it's okay to execute the pattern.
Yeah, I don't think patients or doctors are ready for this move yet.
That move? Hey, have you done CNC work? Absolutely, I want that move. Like, come on.
Yes, you are not the norm.
But imagine it this way. Imagine, like, you scan the gut. You've got a machine in there, a 3D scanner, the whole thing. The tech is already there.
Yeah, and a CNC machine and someone working on your kidney in your body is a very different
– with the right safety features,
cognitive difference.
Absolutely rather have the robot do it. Imagine this. You scan the whole thing. Now you print it in Vue on the side, and you have the robot work on the printed 3D printing version of what they're going to work on. I mean, you can test pass multiple times.
Right, but between you and I – would you prefer a Waymo self-driving car to some random person behind the wheel?
I'd rather have a random person from Waymo. Absolutely.
Compared to Waymo?
Yeah.
Really?
Well, isn't Waymo the company – isn't Waymo the one that's behind Uber that had a couple accidents?
No.
Oh, Waymo is the project by Google?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. I'd rather have Waymo. depends on if it's raining. I mean, there's a few caveats there.
So we are also in a group – we're now self-selecting as a group that trusts the self-driving cars probably more so than the average person.
Okay. So I think a lot of people in the world understand a repetitive machine process and how good that is compared to a human. Take sewing machines, for example. Many people have experiences with sewing machines. They know that the feed rate's going to be stable. They know that, you know, once they start making a line, the only mistake that's going to happen is the human not feeding the cloth incorrectly. At some level, people get it, that when you build a system that's really pretty rock solid, it can be trusted, even if it is run by a computer, because, of course, current sewing machines are run by computers. So it seems to me that fear is just about the unknown aspect of it and the ability to trust a human that you can talk to and engage with. But if you're talking to a doctor and the doctor's like, hey, I'm going to take a look at what's going on and I've got a machine that will do these things for me and this is how it works and I trust it, I think most people are like, okay, cool. What you're saying is does if you go on the street and you say, hey, would you like to have a robot make surgery happen for you or a doctor? People be like, doctor, please. But we're not really talking about that, right? That's just the fear mongering. That's just the white coat fear aspect of it, right?
Yes, but that's also humanity. You're talking about this. That's an irrational fear. That's well,
why
yes,
would people
the irrational,
irrational
fear of humanity is reality. The reality of how people will accept something. Not to mention, it's that whole thing of people talking about when their self-driving car gets into a crash, who do you sue? The person who owns the car, the person who manufactured the car, or the company that wrote the software that was installed into the car? Like, where's the liability? And does it even, track? Is that the right question? These are all questions that are going to come up with if there is a surgery and something goes wrong. Will they blame the fact that it's a robot? Because most likely the person who lost a family member who was grieving, who was told this is going to be a routine surgery, is not going to go like, oh, sure, it could have happened to anyone and it was just a random happenstance. And yes, there's a 5% complication rate, and we were caught in the 5%. People don't do that.
I get it. And it's just the same argument as automated cars. Like, that's all there is to it. It's the same argument, right? When something goes wrong, people are going to be much more cynical about the process and much more likely to say there was a problem in the implementation, even though thousands of people die every day from car accidents. And of course, it's a lot better. And I think at some level, you're going to have to show the efficacy of these robotic and AI-driven surgeries to be better than the doctors doing it themselves. But, you just showed two examples of it already happening, right? So it's just a slow process, progress.
Talked about Google making dinner plans for you. That's fairly, innocuous. But what happens when that is essentially weaponized?
And it makes dinner plans for you.
No, I don't mean that. I don't mean a Skynet type of thing. I mean along the lines of you're pre-programming it to sound like a person so that you can run a scam, a very large-scale scam, so that it's not limited to a confidence game where you yourself have to have a certain set of skills, be able to talk to someone, that you can just figure out how to – like, this is my goal. This is what the conversation is going to be. Now fire off to thousands of people all at once.
Oh, God, that's horrible.
Yes, exactly. This is the concern with regard to AI. And I don't think that the fears are overblown. There's something that you do have to worry about as an industry to say, what are the possible drawbacks? Not just, this is really neat. This is what we can do with it. But what are the bad things that can be done with it as well? And I don't think as an industry we've been as good about doing that as
really?
We should be.
You don't think so? It's funny. Right now I'm getting a lot of spam calls, right? A lot of calls and that are not, your computer is running, that kind of thing.
You've been getting those. Yeah.
Yeah, just like bad. No, it's not. They're not funny calls. They're like, hey, you have a virus on your computer.
They're,
we need to help you.
Yeah, they're a scam. Yeah.
But the thing is that tech right now is always delay a little bit and a weird click and then a volume change sound. And it's very easy to go, are you a human being? And you hang up, right? Like it's not. But when the system's fast enough to go, yeah, of course I am. Hi, I'm sorry, Lyle, right? How will I know? I won't know that, and it'll have to be judicious. And now I generally have this feeling that because we cover all these scary stories online, mm-hmm. Having like Kevin Mitnick on and talking about how you actually manipulate people, mm-hmm. that, a human being can call you and say, hey, I need this information about your credit card. And it sounds like everything's totally fine until you realize, wow, all they knew is my name, and now they're asking for my credit card information. Yeah, that's not going to happen.
Now, what happens when you combine that tech with the Experian dump? Where they know an address,
know
a social security number, a credit card
that's
number,
right.
Birth date.
I mean, I definitely am pretty good about never giving information when people call me. But I do recall that sometimes, somebody will call me. They're from my insurance company, whatever. I'll be like, hang on just a second. I need to call you back. How do I call you back? And they're like, well, you this is my number. I'm like, no, I can't take your number. I need to, through the phone tree of the company, how do I get to you? And then we go through this process of, it's not really possible. I was like, well, can you send me an email? And then, of course, they give me an email with links in it. Well, I can't click on those links. So this kind of game you play with trying to figure out. But the entire time, you're backward engineering a way you could get deceived. That works fine when you're fully awake and you know, have your faculties about you. But if it's a robocall and they can do it anytime they want and they do it consistently and the voices are always different and they know more and more about you, it's going to be really hard to beat that system.
Right. And then you have the AI that answers the call and manages the phone reservations for a restaurant system, so you don't have to have a person. The calls just come in, and then things just show up on your schedule of when people are going to be there, and cross-referencing, was this person a flake last time, you know, stuff like that. And then you end up in this whole situation of an arms race about who has the more persuasive AI or more capable one.
Yeah, I'd pay for a better AI.
Right. But it does go into something like someone being able to pay money for an AI to answer the phone calls and be a screener. And if you don't have the money, you are now no longer being able to to buy the assets of an AI that is programmed in all the methods of persuasion, psychology, privacy, right. Stuff like that.
And earlier I was fighting off the idea of not calling people resources. But of course, when you have an AI, and we won't even get into the idea of possible having sentience later. But anyway, just have a general purpose AI that can do some of these things for you, you will definitely think of them as resources. And when they do replace people, it'll be very hard to not think about them as a resource like people are resources.
Yeah. And the violent series Altered Carbon, you have AI characters that you kind of have some human empathy because they have a human face. And at the same time, they're resources, and they're treated as resources, and they are not on the same level as a person in terms of how much you are willing to sacrifice for them. Reported a little while ago that there were CFCs being found in abundance. Chlorofluorocarbons. They were banned by international treaty a while ago because people noticed, hey, there's this ozone hole showing up above the poles, and that could be really bad. And they were tied directly to the production and emission of CFCs into the atmosphere and things.
I recall this was the 80s and 90s, and all of a sudden my sisters couldn't use that kind of hairspray anymore.
Exactly. And it did very well, and the ozone hole started to look better. And then they started noticing that it was getting worse again, that the amount of CFCs in the atmosphere was higher than it should have been if everyone was sticking to the deal. So the question
who's
then
not sticking to the deal?
Exactly. But it's at a global scale. How do you know where it's coming from? Well, it turns out, and I do love this, they were able to find out where it came from by looking at who was advertising for stuff that would need it.
Oh.
Foam insulation manufacturers apparently were using it to make their products, and they were open about their use of CFC-11.
They didn't know that it was illegal?
They didn't think anyone cared. It was like, this is what we're using. So it was a number of Chinese companies, and it did not require infiltration or, you know, a secret sting operation.
they just advertised. So basically someone just
did and were like, oh.
They just used the internet.
Yeah. They just went online and they were like, hey, look at these ads for people who are doing – like they basically said, like, where would you use CFC-11? Well, you would use it for this thing and this thing and this thing and, you know – hey, foam insulation, you know, it's like that. And then they looked and see all the manufacturers doing it, and some of them were straight up saying,
we're doing that.
Yep, this is what we're using. So now they're going to the next step of saying, okay, now that we've Googled you and found out what you're using, now you need to stop doing it.
The CFC-11, which is also called trichlorofluoromethane, was widely used, first widely used as a refrigerant because it's high boiling point compared to other refrigerants. Interesting. Well, I guess it's good that it's so hard to hide information, especially when you advertise what you're doing with it.
A lot of people were worried it was going to be a lot harder to find because...
Yeah. It's a big world.
It's a big world. I mean, they were able to narrow it down to East Asia, and I'm sure they would have been able to narrow it down to even further to say it was China, and it wouldn't have really surprised anyone. But at the same time, if they had not been so open about it, and that also goes along with, like, they obviously didn't consider it that big of a deal. Who knows if they were really aware of how much international pressure there was to get rid of it. Because yeah. there are regulations galore out there. Some of them are kind of like, we're doing this just because it makes people's lives around there a little bit easier, or we're doing this because of a tariff situation, or we're doing this because of X, Y, or Z. And... Lord knows that – I don't want to single out China, but China is a worse offender than many other places to say, regulations, let's just get her done.
Yeah, it's growing fast. By the way, the molecule of this thing is pretty simple. It's a carbon atom in the center. It's got a fluorine on it, and it's got two chlorines on it that are hard bound, and then a third chlorine that's not as strongly coupled, I guess, probably making it more reactor, you know, more reactinary.
Reactive.
Reactive. Thank you. So it's not like it's a hard thing to make, I'm assuming, right? It's a pretty simple molecule. So, of course, if you want it, you just have to have the base chemicals to create it. Pretty hard to track. And, of course, this could just spring up again. So measuring the global volume of this in the atmosphere is going to be essential for us for a long time.
That's one of the things about CFCs is that they don't degrade quickly.
Let's finish up the show with some space news.
Dawn, the mission, is a foray by NASA to look at the dwarf planet Ceres. It's in the asteroid belt, popularizing the Expanse. And
is it Ceres or Ciri? I guess there's an S in it. Ceres. Okay.
Ceres after the
C-E-R-E-S.
Yeah, from Greek mythology. Ceres.
Who was the Greek? Character series. I'll look it up. You tell us about the story. I'll look it up.
I used to know this off the top of my head. I used to know my Greek mythology like right off the top of my head. But at any rate, so it's making several passes around there and seeing some very interesting things about this dwarf planet, such as white spots. They're like, what is that? And what they're finding is that they believe it to be water that has sublimated from the surface. Now, the water in general on Ceres is expected to be wrapped around the mantle of this dwarf planet rather than on the surface like it is with the Earth. But then squeezing and squishing and moving around, you'll have these geysers where pressure will drive it to the surface. Then when it hits the surface, it'll spray out a bit and of course, turn to ice. Immediately.
Our water is surface mostly because we actually lost all of our water and atmosphere in the early formation of the solar system. And it was blown away basically by the solar winds and the sun igniting and such. And that over time, all of our water is actually from the Kuiper Belt or from other bodies in the outer solar system flying in and landing on us. Comets, effectively, is mm-hmm. where all our waters come from. But in those objects back there, they're from the initial formation. So their hydrogen oxygen mixture is just kind of embedded in their system like the rest of their rock.
Right. Cool. Now, if it's not a saline on Ceres, mostly fresh water.
Why?
Which, well,
just pure.
If you don't have salts there, then you don't have
That's
a saline.
Cool. How much fresh water are we talking about here?
We're talking about potentially, we're not quite sure. That's where they're, what's really exciting that they're making a very close pass to Ceres, whereas before they were something like 200 kilometers away is the closest that they got.
That's pretty close.
385 kilometers was the lowest altitude they ever got. Now they're diving into an orbit that is only 35 kilometers off the surface.
Wow.
Much closer.
And does this thing have visual systems similar to our satellite systems where they can like pick up a football size object?
Yeah, very good. I don't
That's
know.
That's really cool.
It's a different
structure. Yeah, of course. Yeah, and it's long
well,
ways
it's a different
and it's dark
problem,
there.
Yeah. At the same time, what they're thinking they might find is more fresh water than exists on the planet Earth.
That's a lot of water. How big is this thing? I mean, when you say dwarf planet, I'm assuming it's smaller than Pluto.
Right.
Than, yeah.
Now, you have to also remember that when you think of all the water in all the oceans, that is not
fresh
water.
That's salt water. Yeah, sure.
And so if you've ever seen those maps, those topographic maps, where they show the Earth and they take all the water off of it and they show you the sphere that is the oceans, and yeah. It's a fairly small sphere.
Sure. When I mentioned surface, it's surface.
Right. Yeah. And then they say, okay, now here's the sphere that's just fresh water, and it is a tiny pinprick.
But keep in mind that that system of fresh water is circulatory, right? So it keeps changing. The oceans keep we're dumping new fresh water on us.
Whereas
so,
with Sirius, it is not.
That's right. It's just that's
amount. Or if it does circulate, it's next to the mantle.
Yeah, and it's – yeah. So Ceres in ancient Roman religions, Ceres is the goddess of agriculture, grain crops, fertility, and motherly relationships. She was originally the central deity in Rome's so-called plebeian or
– plebeian, yeah.
Yeah, plebeian. And then was paired with her daughter – Proserpina?
Persephone.
Persephone, of course, in what Romans described as the Greek rituals of Ceres. So that's who she is. You recall her now? Sounds like you do.
Yeah, goddess of the hearth. It would have been how I would have referred to her.
Oh, cool.
Just because it's all now flooding back.
Please.
This is the reason behind the seasons, is that her daughter ended up with Hades or Pluto, in the case of Roman mythology. And through deal-making, she was able to get her daughter back for half the year. And so spring is when her daughter comes back, and then summer, and then autumn and winter is when her daughter has to go back and spend the rest of the time with Pluto.
And that's why it gets cold and dark.
And that's why it's Ceres in mourning.
Oh, that's really cool. Thank you. Do you have any idea why Ceres, the dwarf planet, was named that? Just it was time to get another...
Because
Greek
all
God
of our celestial bodies were named after the Greek pantheon, or Roman pantheon, I should say.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence and is used with permission. And GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0, which means you can use our stuff any way you'd like. Just give us some credit. The theme song is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. And today's title... Hate speech and mistrust of pseudo-AI are a matter of timing. The title is by Greg Merkley. I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air I'm with me, and I very much appreciate him being here. It's Miles Elam. Miles, thank you for being on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's see if there's anything that's happened this week. I got something to talk about. It's important. Did I tell you that I totally changed the way the Patreon thing worked?
You told me that you gave everyone their money back.
I didn't do that. What, are you crazy? So the issue is that I haven't been doing consistent GeekSpeak episodes because we just haven't been doing them weekly. But I was still taking money from all the patrons every single month. I was taking the amount that was kind of equivalent to every week episodes. And so I had this guilt and stress and pain, and that was no good for me. So I decided to totally drop all that. And the way I decided to do that was to say, you know what? Patreon has this monthly thing, but they also have this per creative thing where you can just charge per item you create. So I'll just ask everybody that's doing the patronage with us to resubmit an amount of money that they feel good for every episode. And then if I do 4 a month, great. If I do 1 every 2 months, fine. I'm not like stealing anything from anybody.
That's awesome. That sounds a lot more equitable.
Right. So I did the transition, which was just like a toggle. But of course, I don't actually subscribe to myself on the feed, so I don't know how it worked. So luckily, I asked a couple of the patrons to give me a clarity, like, you had a monthly thing and now you have a per creation thing. It says it's the same amount. So let's say you're donating $5 a month and all of a sudden I switch to creation and I submit 5 things in 1 month. Is that $25 or not? So what I found is that if you're a patron, you don't have to do anything. It's going to keep working the same way. It'll effectively be your old monthly is now your maximum per month, and actually also your per item creation. So if I were to create 1 a month, it's the same thing would be going on for you. If I were to create multiples a month, the same amount would go out. So if you want to change your thing to make a representation of how much you want to give per episode to make it more equitable, fine. If you don't care and it's fine, just leave it the way it is. Nice and simple.
So what you're saying is you've given ourselves a economic incentive to do a daily show.
No, I mean, that is true if people actually – only two people sign up for the new process. So everybody else basically in 1 month period, if I make any creations, I will get the total amount. If I create five creations, I only get the same amount. So it's not like that. If people signed up and don't have like a maximum set, yeah, that could work that way. Does that sound like something you want to do? Every day, five-minute episodes? if you want to support GeekSpeak, please feel free. The great thing you could do is just get two more people to listen to the show. Submit on your social feeds or tell some friends you think would like the show that the show exists and have them join us. Because Miles and I do not do this for money. And the current amount, about 20 people that actually donate every month or donate every episode, I guess now, they're doing the amount that actually covers our expenses. So more audience is always good. Bring more people to the party.
Yeah, I was just mulling over my head and like, oh, I could totally do a whole, like, A is for algorithm, B is for blacklist and why you shouldn't use the term.
Dude, if you record a daily bit, that'd be awesome. Put it in the feed. We don't have to charge people for it. So it's funny. I was partially doing this to reduce the stress level for me because when I don't do an extra episode, you know, and all that. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it's actually added more work because now I also have to post on Patreon when I actually do a show, assuming that I do that.
I is for iterator.
I'll tell you what. I welcome you to do that project by yourself. All right, Miles. Thank you so much. That was fun.
All right. Take care, man.